Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we conclude our series In Search of America's Greatest Generation. During the past 3 weeks, we've looked at some of the major competitors, the Revolutionary Generation, the Civil War Generation, and the Great Depression World War II Generation. Today, we look at the Baby Boom Generation with historian David Farber and consider the thoughts of Lori Fendrick on the effects of the events of September 11th on that generation. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On the night of December 15, 1944, Glenn Miller, musician and bandleader who defined the popular music of the 1940s, disappeared over the English Channel. He was flying from England to Paris to entertain troops for the war effort when his plane went down over the Channel due to bad weather. The wreckage was never found. Miller's impact on popular music and culture did not lessen with his disappearance. A trombone player by trade, Miller established himself in the 1920s as a freelance player, performing with and arranging music for notable musicians like the Dorsey Brothers. He also studied music theory and composition, which would later form the basis for his meticulously executed orchestrations that enjoyed immense popularity for their smooth, sweet, and recognizable sound. In 1938, he organized the Glenn Miller Orchestra, which was widely popular for its weekly radio broadcast, as well as recordings and performances on film soundtracks. Among the band's many hits were In the Mood, A String of Pearls, and its theme song, Moonlight Serenade. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Afghanistan, host to some of history's finest civilizations, holds within its borders one of the world's richest archaeological treasures. But since the collapse of the communist government in 1992 and the rise of the conflict between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance, the National Museum in Kabul, which is in charge of preserving the country's archaeological treasures, has found itself on the front lines, looted each time the city changes hands between the warring factions. Archaeologists estimate that about 70% of the museum's collection has disappeared, and that Afghanistan's poor are digging up what artifacts remain at the sites to sell to First World countries just to survive. Cambodian officials in charge of tourism are planning to convert the remote jungle hideout of Pol Pot, the notorious leader of one of the bloodiest regimes in history, into a tourist attraction. Several buildings belonging to Khmer Rouge members, located over 200 miles north of the Cambodian capital, will become museums recounting the country's history. The Khmer Rouge's main execution grounds, the killing fields, and a torture center are already open to the public. From the late 1970s until Pol Pot's death 3 years ago, an estimated 1.7 million people were killed under his infamous regime. This is Talking History.
Every time you kiss me, I'm still not certain that you love me.
They may or may not be the greatest generation, but they are clearly among the most influential in American history. Born during a period of unparalleled prosperity, but also into the Cold War, coming of age during the Vietnam War and being responsible for the turbulent 1960s, the baby boomers have left their mark, and they're not done by any means. Talking History's Fred Nielsen takes a look at the baby boomers with historian David Farber.
My guest David Farber is a professor of history at the University of New Mexico. A leading authority on the 1960s, he's the author of The Age of Great Dreams and other books on the period. His most recent book, co-edited with Beth Bailey, is The Columbia Guide to America in the 1960s. Professor Farber, welcome.
Good to be here.
I wonder if you could remind us at the outset exactly who are the baby boomers and how many are there?
I can give you a formal demographer's answer to that and then build on it with a historian's perspective. Formally, the baby boomers are those born between 1946 and 1964, about 75, 76 million of them. And they're called the baby boomers because during that era, the fertility rate, that's the number of births per 1,000 women, went over 100 during that entire period of time. We've never done that before or since. So it's an extraordinarily fertile period in American history. And then we, I think, as Americans tend to think of them as a baby boomer, because of the extraordinary set of events that they both made and witnessed and confronted.
But babies, of course, are born all the time, and to group people into generations is a somewhat arbitrary exercise, I suppose. Apart from the things you've mentioned, I wonder how people come to be identified, particularly how do they come to identify themselves as members of a generation? Or more specifically, how did baby boomers come to see themselves as baby boomers?
I think in that case, older Americans help them to see themselves that way. You got to remember, there were so many of them born at a time of general prosperity that they became a tremendous marketing opportunity. And you can really trace baby boomers kind of working their way through America's structure by what's being sold to whom. So that baby cribs became a growth industry by the late 1940s, and baby furniture and bigger houses, so that those 3.2 children born to the average American family had somewhere to live. And then you could watch them buy bicycles, you could watch them buy toys, you could watch Davy Crockett hats become epidemic throughout the United States, and Barbie dolls by the late 50s. And so because marketers are casting these people as a coherent group to sell things to, that's the first step, I think. Television programming, music, all of that is aimed at this huge demographic population. Then, secondarily, this is another group for the first time that stays together. I think it's hard for Americans to remember that as late as the 1920s, only about 25% of children graduated high school. By 1965, 75% of young people are graduating high school, and about half of those go on to college together. So they're a marketing group, then they're a student population, and then, of course, as we all know, they're a population that confronts the war in Vietnam, racial turmoil, struggles for racial justice, and a whole series of other events that I think create in many ways for them and for those of us who came later and some before a sense these were a specific population of people who had a coherency to them. Now, that's only half true, but it's true enough, I think.
You've alluded to the extraordinary opportunities for marketers here. Certainly the boomers grew up in a period of extraordinary prosperity. In addition, they were the first generation to grow up with TV. They grew up with the Cold War. Apart from buying opportunities for them, how did this prosperous period after World War II shape them, shape their attitudes and lives?
Well, I think it gave them a sense of possibility. It's important to remember that the generation that came before them was very small, which helped to magnify the seeming size of the baby boomers themselves. And the preceding generation was small because they were confronting the Great Depression, a time when one out of four Americans couldn't find work. So you've got young people born to parents who were facing their own sorrows and then suddenly shelling out money to these young people. And these young people said, my God, it's all possible. There's money in the bank. There's money in our house. We've got television. We've got radio. We've got stereos. We can make a difference in the world because we're expected to. And they saw themselves as an optimistic generation, and somebody like President John Kennedy certainly spoke to that in the kinds of speeches he gave, his very aura. And this was a generation, in some ways, born to possibility.
They're born in the 40s, 50s. They continue to be born, of course, into the 1960s, as you've said. And yet, to a considerable extent, I think the baby boomers are associated still with the 1960s, which is, I note, an increasingly long time ago. My daughter's as far removed from Sergeant Pepper as I am from Al Jolson, which is an extraordinary jolt whenever I think about it. I wonder, is this linkage of the baby boom generation with the 60s an appropriate one?
Well, it's almost literally half true. If you think about it, about half the baby boomer generation did come of age in the 1960s, and almost half of it came of age after the 1960s. But I think because so many extraordinary things happened in the 60s, that's the historical moment for this so-called generation, which, as you just suggested, in many ways, is there are too many years there for that to be one generation. It's really almost two. But those who came of age in the 60s, who went to Vietnam, who went down south to march in civil rights, who led the movement for civil rights at black colleges and universities in the 1960s, I think those are the people we tend to associate with that era.
To the extent, then, that the 60s are a formative experience for a large portion of the generation, if not all of it, their experience was certainly quite different from that of the previous generation. The World War II, even the Depression generations, were shaped by events that brought the country together the convulsions of the 60s, if anything, drove them apart. And I wonder how that affects the generation's attitudes and even other people's views of them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think World War II was an extraordinary period in American life. Maybe, if you think back, the only time that the country was so unified for just really a handful of years, because, of course, right up to World War II, the country was deeply divided about whether or not we should participate in that epic struggle. So you're right, for about 4 years, the country was almost uniquely unified. And certainly in the 1960s, like the 1860s, that was not the case. We had searing events, but in many ways you're right, searing events that split the country in some ways. Those who saw the new changes in lifestyle as good, more liberatory, those who saw them as immoral and wrong, those who saw the war in Vietnam as an important struggle against communism, those who saw it as a mistake, a tragic turn against third world nationalism, those who were for racial justice, and let's not forget tens of millions of Americans who opposed changes in our race structure. You're right. The 1960s were not a period that brought America together, despite Richard Nixon's slogan when he ran again in 1972 to come together, to bring us together. It didn't happen, and Nixon perhaps is a good symbol of that polarization.
Nixon, of course, is himself a product of an earlier generation. What strikes me is that many of the boomers themselves continue those divides long after the 60s are over. I wonder what, if anything, we can conclude from the fact that Bill Clinton and Rush Limbaugh are both baby boomers.
I think it's normal American history. Sometimes we like to think that we're a country built on consensus, and in some deep way we are. We believe in democracy. We believe in individual rights. But democracies, by nature, are filled with conflict, and there's nothing wrong with it. And the 1960s were perhaps more conflict than most Americans could handle. But sometimes when you face deep troubles, a system of racial injustice, you're going to have to fight each other, hopefully peacefully, hopefully through the ballot box. But democracies are dependent on honorable, reasoned conflict. And I think the baby boomers' legacy in some ways is an attempt to resurrect democracy and make people face up to sometimes our nation's troubles and wrestle them out.
We speak of generations usually in the singular. We speak of the World War II generation, and you've suggested that at least for the period of 4 years of war, to speak in the singular of shared experience and commitment makes some sense. I wonder, can we speak of the baby boom generation in the singular in the same way, or are the divides too deep for that kind of characterization to make any sense?
I think at least for that first half of the baby boom generation, they share a common ground. They don't stand in the same place on that common ground. They're divided, as is suggested by Limbaugh and Clinton, or for that matter, Al Gore and George W. Bush, other baby boomers. But they did share some of the same struggles. And even if they're on either side of that struggle, I think it does create some commonality. And I think that is something that they've carried with them the rest of their lives.
As a historian, I wonder whether talking in terms of generations is a useful thing to do. Historians have, for a long time, at least some of them, used categories like gender, race, class, ethnicity, various aspects of people's background to try to understand the American experience. Are generations a useful category?
I think sometimes people share such searing experiences that it makes sense. During World War II, the Civil War, the revolutionary generation of the 18th century, maybe the 1960s, but I don't think that that's normal. I don't think it's easy to talk about generations over the last 25 years in any meaningful sense. We did it as marketing tools, Gen X and things like that, but it didn't really take. I think for long periods of time, it isn't a single age cohort that is making history or witnessing history in any specific manner. Often it's a common experience of many people across all sorts of different divides. But once in a while, maybe the 60s, I think we can talk about a generation.
So those who try to explain all of American history, as some best-selling books have recently tried to do, in terms of the sequence of one generation in a rather deterministic way, following another with certain characteristics, would that be a rather ahistorical approach, do you think?
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. I think that people, even the baby boomer generations, I mean, Martin Luther King was born in 1929. Tom Hayden, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, none of them were baby boomers. Mm-hmm. So even at the best of generational times, it's more a way to help think about something than it is really to structure it. Yeah, I don't think it is very good history in general to see things generationally.
There's so much talk these days, thanks primarily to Tom Brokaw's books, about the greatest generation, so-called, of the Depression and World War II. Now, you're a historian who concentrates primarily on a later period, in the 60s. I wonder how you view such claims for an earlier generation?
Again, greatest generation is more perhaps a marketing tool than a tough-minded historical analysis, but for sure, those who fought in World War II had a rendezvous with destiny. They did something extraordinary, and I think, again, in the 20th century, they uniquely sacrificed for their nation, for their families, and their communities. I would in no way belittle that. But it is useful to remember that the 1940s marked a time of great prosperity in American history after 10 long years of struggle, and most Americans had little to nothing to do with the war. So I don't know who we're talking about sometimes when we say the best generation. A courageous band of men who went off to fight a war, for sure. Just as those who fought in the Civil Rights Movement in many ways made their own sacrifices. We have a lot of Americans who could vie for the title of heroes and courageous people. Those World War II vets, obviously, among them. So I don't know. That probably doesn't ring so true for me. I'm impressed. I'm excited. I'm thankful to that generation. But the greatest, I don't know. That doesn't mean much to me.
There are various generations that people would nominate for the greatest, should they wish to pursue that. Some would suggest the founders, perhaps the Civil War generation. Of course, we've mentioned Tom Brokaw and others nominating the Depression and World War II generations as the greatest. Absolutely no one that I'm aware of does the same for the baby boomers. They get these days an extraordinary amount of bad press. They are, we're told, self-indulgent, self-absorbed, narcissistic, and materialistic. I wonder, are those characterizations of the baby boomers fair?
No, the short answer. Again, this is a generation that at least some of them fought in Vietnam. Many died. Others made tremendous sacrifices, as I said, and struggles to create justice in the United States for women, for men, for African Americans, for people of color. On the other hand, I do think that the question introduces a problem that we've been thinking about for half a century. We're a country that's enjoying tremendous prosperity in world historic terms. And luxury and democracy don't fit easily together, as the great philosopher said. And I think we don't quite know what to make of the fact that we are, as a people, for three or four generations now, blessed with incredible prosperity that produces, yeah, a lot of self-absorption, narcissism, materialism, and other, perhaps, vices. That's a history that we're still trying to think through what it means in our own long experiment.
I wonder if part of the problem with the boomers is that at least part of the generation in the 60s and into the 70s and after raised precisely those kinds of philosophical questions that you mentioned. One should question what one does for one's work, what one makes of one's life. And is it conjunction of that questioning with the real-world prosperity that leads to some of the criticism?
I think you're right. I think maybe in the end what we'll say one of the great legacies of the 60s generation was what does the button always say? Question authority. Mm. And that doesn't come easily to a society, and it's easy to attack the messenger in some ways for those who say, what is the point of working 8 to 6 every day? What is the point of all of this work? And, hey, those are tough questions. And I think that's a kind of cultural history that is harder to put into a book like it is to say those are the men who went and fought World War II. And it's a different kind of legacy. It's a different kind of generational struggle. And I think still a useful one for us all to ponder.
Realizing that the baby boomers are still with us, that especially means something to me. I hope to be around for a while. How have the baby boomers changed America in historical terms?
I suppose you could say in three ways. One, they are the first generation who have willfully attempted to create a more equitable society, something that has not historically been with the United States. And we're wrestling with that, with multiculturalism, with diversity questions, with all sorts of issues of fairness. Secondly, I think it is a generation, as we just suggested, that's the first to wrestle with a lifetime of expected prosperity. Not that we've all had it, but that we somehow think of it as a birthright. And I think that's something, again, we're still trying to think through. And the third is, I think it's a generation that more than any in recent memory has had to face the question of what is legitimate authority at the workplace, in our political system, even in our own homes, who's the boss. And those questions of authority have created a lot of strife and difficulty in our society, but I think are finally a very useful set of questions to be asking.
Well, Professor Farber, thanks for visiting with us today.
Thank you.
I've been visiting with David Farber, the author of The Age of Great Dreams and the editor of the recently published Columbia Guide to America in the 1960s.
The generation known as the baby boomers is now at the height of its power and influence in America. And just what effect did the events of September 11th have on it? That's the subject of this week's commentary by Lori Fendrick. Fendrick is a professor of fine arts at Hofstra University on Long Island, New York, and she lives not far from what used to be the World Trade Center.
The post-World War II generation, my generation, is known for its devotion to self-fulfillment and success. Going to therapy sessions and studying Buddhism blend with owning two homes and getting the kid into Princeton. My generation made shopping a national industry and decided that instant communication of information was the same as knowledge. Most of us never knew war directly. Instead, we watched it on television. We came of age during the Vietnam War. For those of us who opposed it, our first moves as young citizens were acts of civil disobedience. From this, we learned to equate good citizenship with dissent. As for later years, the invasion of Grenada or the Persian Gulf War, they just plain didn't exist for us. At the same time the Vietnam War was raging, the dominant American artist was Andy Warhol. Warhol's ironic hedonism was profoundly different from the anger generated by the Vietnam War. Yet both fed the post-60s culture of slavering over celebrities and material goods, while at the same time mocking them. Our citizenship of dissent eventually degenerated into an ironic disillusionment with our government and with American mass culture in general. Finally, because 20th century horrors turned belief in absolute truth into an absurdity, my generation embraced relativism. We believed it all depends on where you're coming from. We also are the tolerant generation. We value diversity. And we are the honest generation. We decided that the highest moral values are individual or personal honesty, not bravery, virtue, or duty. My generation does not use the word citizen very easily. The word makes us squirm. Self-sacrifice is another uncomfortable, faraway word. In fact, most people my age have never had the occasion to practice real self-sacrifice. Never finding a noble cause, we settled on working at our personal happiness. The September 11th attack on our country demolished my generation's proposition that the purpose of life is self-fulfillment and success. Skilled at discussing our personal lives, we don't know how to behave as citizens. Now, in one horrible hour, these are, in Tom Paine's words, the times that try men's souls. This is a test of our generation. It will reveal whether or not we can get beyond our mere selves and become genuine citizens.
You've been listening to Lori Fendrick, essayist and professor of fine arts at Hofstra University, and this is Talking History.
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried.
The baby boom generation may have made headlines in the 1960s, but it grew up in the 1950s, a period for which Americans have unbridled nostalgia. For our site of the week, we've selected an exhibit from which you will learn what the 1950s were really like, or not. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
At the Michigan Historical Museum in Lansing, you will find a variety of exhibits, including one called The 50s at Home. Here you will see a typical 1950s living room, kitchen, and bathroom. The gallery features chairs of molded plywood, pink appliances, and products that most of us grew up with in the kitchen, including the original Kellogg's products like Sugar Smacks and Sugar Frosted Flakes. Between 1954 and 1955, specially commissioned Norman Rockwell Kids appeared on Kellogg's packages. And don't miss the S&H Green Stamp store exhibit, filled with products typically found in the 1950s stores. The Michigan Historical Museum is located in the Michigan Historical Center and sponsors special events throughout the year.
And finally, turning to our segment on coming attractions, in what many will see as incredibly ironic timing, an exhibit of flags, mom, and apple pie has arrived at Ground Zero. The Art of Norman Rockwell has opened at the Guggenheim Museum in New York City. Rockwell was the first to say that he painted only fantasy, that his art wasn't true to life. His detractors said his work was not about the real world, but a sanitized cornball version of it. Well, since September 11th, in our flag-shrouded anxiety, the cornball sentiments in, say, Freedom from Fear, with mom and dad tucking the kids into bed, dad clutching a newspaper with the words horror and bombings in the headline, seem less remote and contrived than they did only 3 months ago. Call it patriotic escapism, but this exhibit of America's greatest modern illustrator may be just what we need. After all, what Rockwell painted was not what America in its complexity ever quite looked like. But at his best, he captured what many Americans felt and desired, and many now need, which is truth on a level deeper than surface appearance. If you happen to be in New York before March 3rd and have time to view Norman Rockwell pictures for the American people at the Guggenheim Museum, see if you agree. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Laveau.
Our daddies won the war, then they came home to our moms. They gave them so much love that all us kids were born. We all grew up on Mickey Mouse and a hula hoop. Then we all bought BMWs and brand new pickup trucks. And we watched John Kennedy die one afternoon. In love to the baby. It was a time of new prosperity in the USA. All the fortunate offspring never had a say. We had sympathy for the devil and the Rolling Stones. Then we got a little older, we found Haggard and Jones. Eight generations.